Hey, and welcome back to Extra Features Interview. Today we have a fantastic film. I'm going to let him discuss it, because it's a little bit different than what we normally do on the show. We have Richie Dutton. He's the creator of Shadows of a Stranger. And, Rach, welcome to the show.
Hello there. Thanks for having me.
I have to start off right immediately. I read a little bit of your bio. I do try not to read a lot of them, because it kind of ruins the interview.
Okay.
And I want to know why you guys went all blue screen, because you guys complained about a budget issue, but I didn't see that when I saw the film.
All right. Yeah, I mean, that was the approach that we took. I mean, just to sort of go back how it all started, really. I mean, I came up with this script way back in 2002, I think it was, and I'd sort of shelved it. You know, I was trying to sell it to producers because it was, you know, set in this big city and nothing like where I live. You know, I was trying to get producers interested and sort of struggling. And in the end, I just sort of shelved the script until about 7 years later. And I dug it out again and reread it and thought, actually, it's not a bad film, and, you know, not a bad script, this. So I gave it to my filmmaker friend to read, and he read it all in one night and said, yeah, we should, you know, we need to push to get this made. So, you know, we explored contacting producers again, but in the end he said, I've got an idea, let's make this film ourselves, we didn't practice, you know, basically didn't really have a budget, but he said, I've got this idea to shoot it all on blue screen. And he talked about the film Sin City, which was sort of had recently been out probably a couple of years around that time, and we sat and watched that one night, and he sort of explained the plan to me. This is Chris Clark, who co-directed with me, and in the end I said, yeah, okay, let's go for it, you know, nothing to lose. And you know, it was all new to me, this blue screen approach. That's what we decided to do.
So you said, you had just told me you had this script shelved for 7 years. So were you making other films at this time?
Yeah, we did make a couple of other films with another filmmaker. Chris and I were working with someone else, and we actually made two feature films with this other guy, and sadly they never saw the light of day. So, you know, for us it became we were very frustrated with our filmmaking endeavors, and, you know, we were sort of feeling inspired, thinking, oh, you know, we could do this better ourselves. So, you know, that's essentially what we decided to do, was to go our own way and make our own film. So we kind of learned how not to make a film. So we learned some valuable lessons, even though when, you know, things do go really wrong, it's, you know, you've got to see it all as learning experiences, and you know, take what you can from that, and that's what we did. And yeah, it was quite empowering in a sense to find our own feet and to go our own way and make our own film. That's what we did with Shadows.
So when you were writing Shadows, did you have a vision in mind, or it all just came to you one night, or just a process?
It was a fairly slow process. Yeah, I remember. I was probably reading a lot of Dean Koontz novels at the time, and I remember one film that inspired me a lot to write the script was the film Seven with Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman, which I remember seeing that film and thinking, oh, you know, if I could ever have the chance to make a film, this is exactly the kind of film that I would make. So that was kind of a big inspiration, having this kind of real dark and gritty thriller. It was, you know, it was very, very psychological and very atmospheric. So that's certainly what I had in mind, that kind of feel of a film. And like I say, shooting it, you know, set in a big city, a fictional city I called Meridian. But, you know, I imagine basically somewhere like London or, you know, somewhere like that would, is the basic kind of ballpark. But, you know, for us, we're rural, Lincolnshire, filmmakers. We live in a town called Sleaford, which, you know, is a small town in comparison. So essentially it wasn't the location to shoot such a film. So again, you know, the blue screen approach lent itself very well, to the script, because we could obviously create, you know, our own city from scratch. So,
okay. You know, I'm going to have to ask you, did you work off photo reference, or how did you do the blue screen? Like, how does that work?
What we did, we did have a library, or one or two libraries of textures that we could use to create everything. But we also took a lot of photographs. So I'd photographed a lot of Sleaford. I think, you know, my hometown, a lot of the buildings around here made it into the film. But, you know, I'd also go to cities. I went to, for example, Lincoln and Nottingham. I remember even Aberdeen, I happened to be in during the making of it. So I took some photographs while I was up there. So it was kind of a Frankenstein of all these cities in Britain, which we then composited in using After Effects. But yeah, some of the locations we had to sort of completely create from scratch, in a sense, because, you know, there are certain buildings I had in mind, certain look I had in mind, and I just couldn't find them anywhere. So, you know, one or two buildings we just sort of, you know, essentially built from scratch. But, you know, it's quite exciting, you know, as a filmmaker to be able to, you know, to have a vision in your head, and, you know, while you're at the computer and having all these images to bring it together and to, you know, to create that image as you see it in your head. It was, you know, I found it a really satisfying process to be able to do that. Because, you know, often as independent filmmakers, you're making compromises all the time and having to work with, you know, with what you have around you. But, you know, the blue screen approach really sort of opened things up for us, and that, you know, you've got this complete blank canvas to build what you want. So yeah, I found it really exciting to do that.
Yeah. Did you find with the blue screen you were missing some transition? Because I did notice you didn't have a lot of transition scenes. Like, I didn't see people going from place to place. I see them come out of something.
Yeah.
And then you would fade into the next location.
Yes. Yeah. There's certain limitations, I suppose you have. We sort of used the old sort of establishing shot of a building, and then we're suddenly in the building. I think I had in mind, well, certainly in other aspects of the film, but we had in mind cartoons like The Simpsons and Family Guy, where, you know, you suddenly cut to a building, and then, you know, sort of quick establishing shot, and then we're inside that building, and the preceding scene takes place. So yeah, there was, I guess, put that down to an influence, maybe.
Okay. You know, I'm going to have to ask you about your actors, because, I mean, you took away my favorite conversation, is all your locations, but you don't really have any. So did you shoot this all on the same stage?
Yes, yeah. What we did, we were searching. We knew we needed a big space to create our own blue screen studio. That was perhaps the biggest challenge to begin with. First of all found, well, we're offered the use of, it's like an old kind of warehouse. So we constructed the blue screen studio in there. And then it was very much a low moment, but we then found out that we were unable to proceed with using this space, so we were essentially kicked out of there. So we were then, the guy that had found this space, he then sort of frantically looked around. This is our associate producer, Trevor Glenn. He then called on one of his farmer friends who had a barn that he wasn't really using. So he let us use that, and as it happens, it was a much better space because it was situated down the fens, and it was sort of, you know, away from the main road and fairly quiet there. There was tractors and jet planes going overhead all the time, but yeah, it was a really good space. So that's where we set up our blue screen, and for the bulk of the filming, that's where we shot it. Over a period of roughly 3.5 months.
Oh wow!
We did have a lot of pickups in the preceding years. We kept thinking, oh yeah, we need some more extras to populate our scene. So we then had a sort of mobile blue screen studio, which we set up in various places, even in my garage at one point. And we just kept filming and filming, but yeah, the bulk of the production was done in this farmer's barn, essentially, which is near a village in Lincolnshire called Billinghay. So we imaginatively called it Billy Wood Studios. So that was what we called it.
So hang on, it took you 3.5 months to film the picture. Now, how much to do the blue screen to get everything done then?
Yeah, that was quite the time-consuming stage of the project. It took us probably about 8 months, I think, to edit it. Just having a blue screen edit with no visual effects work done, and then so that was took us to 2011, and then it was a further. We were doing the visuals for 3 years then. But that was all shared between myself and Chris Clark, my co-director. It was a bit unfortunate that the script was quite long, so there was a lot of scenes to do, and we did end up cutting a fair amount of the film. Certain scenes we didn't even do the visuals to, but yeah, that was certainly a very very time consuming, very fiddly job to do that one.
Well, you have a running time of 1 hour and 46 minutes, so I'm trying to figure out what I'm missing, what you cut. I'm dying to know, because your story is very tight. Like, I didn't find any, like, I need to know this or I need to know that. It was all there.
That's good. That's good to hear. It was sort of a subplot, really, with Xander's relationship with Samantha, the daughter of his friend. There was a lot more exploration of that. So there was certain scenes where they first when they first meet, when Xander comes around to David's house, sort of near the beginning. She opens the door. That's still in the cut, but there was actually another scene there where David's not actually home at that point, so it's just Xander and Samantha on her own, and they're sort of waiting for David to come home from work. So that was one scene, and then sort of more scandalously later on, Samantha's getting very close to Xander
on the couch.
She essentially tries it on with him in one scene.
I knew it. I knew you caught me there. I know exactly the scene, because I'm like, there's got to be more to this, because you kind of cut, and then you see her kind of sleeping on him.
Yeah, that was...
I know where your cut is.
Yeah, well, yeah, that sort of pre-echoed it. I mean, the cut scene was a little bit further on, but yeah, that kind of, that was building up to it, for sure, that was, yeah. So yeah, there was a lot more to it, so with their relationship. I felt that it made sense to cut that scene. I mean, you know, we were certainly looking to have a better running time, but I mean, not sort of giving too much of the story away, but I thought it made sense if she didn't sort of throw herself at him. I thought it made more sense.
I did feel she was going to at one point. I definitely would say I expect her to.
Yeah.
Now,
that's, yeah.
How did you find your actors?
I think all in all, we had a really good bunch of actors. I mean, that was again something we spent a lot of time on was the casting. And you know, as you know, we have an intriguing sort of blend of actors such as Colin Baker, who was in Doctor Who, and various other actors who have been in children's TV shows. Perhaps you won't have heard of them in Canada, but on CBeebies, which is like the BBC children's channel, the actress Sarah Jane Honeywell, she was a bit of a celeb on that channel, and Jane Tucker and Malcolm Lord. Jane plays Mr. Rella, Malcolm Lord played Brandis. They were both in a show called Rainbow, which is something I watched when I was growing up. So I was quite in awe of these two when they came to do their scenes. So yeah, we had those sort of caliber of actor, and then we held open auditions locally. So we had a lot of, you know, local actors sort of filling pretty much most of the rest of the roles. I mean, Ian, he was living in Sleaford at the time. We did have an established actor who was going to play the lead role called James Aubrey. He was in a film called Lord of the Flies, which was a bit of a classic.
I've seen that.
Quite a big film in its day. I think it's probably around the 60s, I think it was. He was obviously a young boy when he filmed that one. So yeah, he was set to play the lead role, but I sort of had the feeling at the time that he wasn't in a great state, and he wasn't doing too well, and sadly, tragically, he died right before we started filming. But fortunately for the project, we were well prepared, and we had contingencies. So that's when Ian stepped in. He was actually set to play one of the policemen in the opening scene, but he got quite the promotion. And then Chris Clark, my fellow director, he played Xander, the other lead.
Oh, so, yeah, right. The other director is Xander with the beard.
Yeah, that's Chris.
Okay.
Chris Clark. Yeah, I was hoping he might have been able to join us tonight on the interview, but he's probably playing in his band somewhere tonight, so or rehearsing or something. But yeah, he played that role. So yeah, it was you know, it was an intriguing blend. We did do a bit of casting online as well, and that's where we got in touch with Paul Kelleher, who is an American actor but based in England, and he played a supporting role in Johnny. I thought he was a thoroughly excellent actor, so I was really pleased, you know, working with them, and everyone was. I think one of the things I'll, you know, I'm very pleased about with the film is the casting. I think we filled the roles well. You know, I was, you know, really pleased with how it all came together, really.
I guess my question is, I mean, you got, I wanted to get into the acting because in the sense that I thought they did a, they seemed like real actors to me.
Yeah, well, that's good. Yeah.
And I mean, I did feel they all suited the roles and Chris did a good job of that guy that looked out of place. He did a good job of that. Maybe it was his first role and it worked for that reason.
Yeah.
Because he's not really contingency. They just sort of add him into your plot as you go. You need him, obviously. No, yeah. I guess my question is, how do you get such established talent? I mean, you're an independent filmmaker, and you have the Sixth Doctor, you have these people from children's TV. Where do you get them? Like, you're not paying them a lot, I presume.
Yeah, I mean, we were very, very low budgeted. But, yeah, I mean, it was a bit of cheekiness, I suppose, on our part, and a bit of opportunism. I mean, as it happened, Chris is friends with Jane Tucker, who plays Miss Sorella, and in turn she happened to be friends with Colin Baker, and I suppose it was just like I say, opportunistic. I think she happened to mention to him one time when we were talking to her about the film that she was having dinner with Colin Baker, and we thought, oh, wow, he would actually be really good to play William Fallon in the film.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Should we get Jane to talk to him? So we thought, well, we've got nothing to lose. Let's just go for it. So, yeah, Chris went for it, and Jane sort of was acting as an agent in a sense. But, yeah, she kindly talked to Colin. I think initially he politely demurred, as he put it, but with a bit of arm twisting, he eventually read the script and said, "Yeah, actually, it's not so bad, this." And yeah, eventually we were able to convince him to do it. So yeah, it was a bit of cheekiness, I think, just being brash and going for it, I think.
I guess my big question is, you said you didn't get a lot of exposure in this film, but wouldn't your cast alone to me would argue that you should have had more exposure?
Yeah. We were obviously thrilled when Colin Baker, you know, agreed to be in the film, and we thought, you know, wow, this is, you know, really big. A big name we've got here. You know, he was the Doctor in Doctor Who, and you know, he was our Doctor. You know, we both grew up watching him. So yeah, you know, we thought this is, you know, really big name to have on board here. And again, you know, another Colin who was part of the project, Colin McFarlane, who he's not in the film, but he provided the voice for the villain. You know, Colin's probably a bigger name again over here, but you know, he's recently been in the film The Commuter with Liam Neeson, which was just out in the cinemas beginning of this year. And you know, again, he was in Batman Begins as well. You know,
seen that too.
Christopher Nolan film, so. Yeah, we thought that with these names, everyone's surely going to be wanting to see our film.
I would say so. From what you think, I do have some questions. You have a scene with snow on the ground and a woman in shorts. I thought that was strange.
Yeah, it's an interesting to pick out that scene. I mean, the thing to remember, obviously, is that, you know, it's a film about people with psychic powers, you know, and that was a moment with the character Xander, who, you know, as we know in the film, he has these acute sort of psychic powers. He's able to read minds and such. Yeah, that, I mean, the sort of origins of that idea was that I remember in reading the Stephen King book, The Shining, which, again, that was essentially about characters with psychic powers. I remember the character, I can't remember his name, but he's played by Scatman Crothers. He says that whenever he's about to have a big psychic experience, he would smell oranges. And I thought, yeah, that's interesting idea, that there's kind of these blend of senses. And so I sort of ripped off that idea in a sense. Uh-huh. But I changed it because obviously in film you can't really do smell, but I thought, what about if Xander has little visions that sort of happen when he's about to have a sort of important psychic revelation, and that particular lady in who's, yes, kind of scantily clad when it's the middle of winter. Yeah, she appears whenever he's about to have one of his kind of major visions in the film. Three times it happens, really. But yeah, that was all going on in his mind, essentially.
So I don't know if any of these lines are going to help you, but I did write down some lines that made me laugh. Believing is worth the gamble.
Uh-huh.
I like that one.
Yeah.
I thought that was good. Pedo, what is that? P-E-D-O. I don't know what that is.
Pedo. yeah, it's a shortened word for pedophile, pedophile.
Okay, that's what I thought, but I said, I got to ask.
Yeah, it's just their take on it as they'd been shunned by Xander. So,
it's just a... This is a weird question. Since I knew you were from England, the daughter, Samantha, says TV not telly at one scene. I thought that was really strange.
All right. Yeah, she does say that, doesn't she? Yeah, let's see what's on TV. Yeah, I mean, we do sometimes say TV. But, yeah, do we say telly most of all? Yeah, I suppose we do.
I've never heard a British person say TV, so I kind of wrote that down and said, didn't expect that to come out.
We're so familiar with American culture. I know I certainly pick up Americanisms. I prefer the word ass to ask. You know, we say ass over it, but I don't know. I think ass sounds better.
Fair enough. I also made a note about Chris's earrings. He has keys for earrings.
Yeah, I remember him. When he was cultivating his Xander appearance, and he did talk to me about all the details, and he did have this idea that he would have this little key dangling from his earring. That was purely Chris's idea. It wasn't scripted or anything, but I think. I think he may have said at the time that it could have perhaps belonged to a former, an ex-girlfriend, maybe. I think that was his thinking with that one. It was some kind of connection, mysterious connection to his past, I think.
So is the music in the film all Chris's then?
The music was all done by a local choir that we brought on board. Chris sort of had the idea, really, that he wanted a lot of sort of old-style Christmas carols, Christmas tunes. He particularly wanted Gabriel's message, which is the sort of main kind of theme, musical theme that we use in the film. So we searched around for a choir so that we could record all this music, and we had to find someone as well who could arrange all the music, because a lot of these Christmas carols, although they're public domain and anyone can use them, but there's still potentially be copyright issues in the arrangements of them. So we we got a guy to arrange them all, and he actually ran his own choirs. And I mean, you know, there weren't not a professional choir as such, but you know, I think they've done some sort of little tours and things. But yeah, they were excellent. This choir over in Spalding, I think they were based. But Chris kind of directed a lot of that. A lot of the music was his ideas. But yeah, we were, with it being a Christmas-based film, we certainly wanted all this Christmas music to be used. And even then, we had all this choral music done for the film, but we were still searching around for any royalty free copyright free music that we could use, and particularly Christmas related music. So
you may not want to answer my last question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. At the beginning of the film, we meet Xander in a bar with a girl.
Yeah.
At the end of the film, we meet the same girl again.
Yeah.
Now, did you really want it? Like, did you ever change that ending, or was that always set ending? I'm going to be very vague because I don't want to ruin the end of the film, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. That was always intended. Yeah. I know it's a bit of a, well, again, don't want to give too much away, but yeah, it was a down note, I suppose. But that was always intended. I like to sort of avoid too many cliches in films, and the one you often see is, everyone happily walking off into the sunset. And yes, I do like there to be resolutions in the film, but at the same time, I think, often endings, they come at a price, and it can be plenty of shades of grey, and it's not, it can be black and white. So that was kind of my thinking with that.
I just felt he deserved something for what he did.
Sorry, what was that?
He felt he did something. I mean, he wasn't really doing it for the money.
Yeah.
He was just doing it to be helpful, and I really felt he needed direction at that point.
Yeah.
And he kind of found himself by the end of the film, without giving anything away, and I'm kind of like, okay, he's going to start his next life.
Yeah.
But he doesn't.
Perhaps it leaves it open for his story to continue in another film if anything ever comes. But yeah, I know totally what you're saying. And funny enough, we were recording a director's commentary recently, which we're going to be releasing in the not too distant future. It's almost ready to go. And that was one of the very things that we happened to talk about, actually, in the commentary is, what happens with Xander, David makes a promise to him in the film, and, does he keep the promise? There's certain things that are left, open-ended, in a sense.
I think David keeps his promise. I really do.
Yeah, I think.
I can't see him not doing it, because he wouldn't have gotten there without Xander. He knows that.
Yeah. Yeah, he'd be not a very nice person if he was to renege on his agreement for definite. Yeah, so, essentially, David is a good guy.
I think he is. Although,
yeah, he has his shadows, but yeah, deep down he's a good guy, and hopefully someone that the audience root for. So
you got the film completed. You've done all your work? Did you take it on the road?
We did enter into a few film festivals when we first completed it. This was back in 2014, which we didn't actually get into any of them. Sadly, it was very, very frustrating.
Really?
Yeah, I'm shocked by that. I mean, I suppose we were shooting a bit high with these particular festivals, so we perhaps should have then started to go on to, you know, smaller ones, be a bit more realistic with it, perhaps. But there were certain developments going on at the time that meant that we had to put it on hold. But just this December gone, we did enter into a festival in Seattle called the Anglicon Festival. It was, as the name suggests, it was a festival that celebrates English films and English related films. So we did enter into that, and it actually won a prize in that one, which was very great to see. Just trying to remember what the title was. I think it's best feature. I should know this.
It's all good. It's all good. You didn't expect that question.
we would have loved to for it to get more exposure, and we're still hopeful that the people are going to see it. It's available now on Amazon, and hopefully if it piqued anyone's interest, anyone listening to this and they want to go see it, then it's available right now to go see.
Well, this is everybody's favorite part of the show. Actually, I think just mine, but I'm going to do it to you anyway. Your favorite film?
My favorite film, probably The Empire Strikes Back, I think I would say.
Or
Jaws, one of the two.
Wow, we're going full on hardcore blockbusters. I love it. Now, have you seen Jaws 2, 3, and 4?
Jaws, I like Jaws 2, actually. Jaws 3 was kind of starting to lose my interest, and Jaws 4,
it's terrible. I think 3 and 4 are terrible. 2 is watchable. I like 2, you kind of got to finish off the story from 1.
Yeah, it was nice that it continued with the characters, I thought. You know, there's a lot, and it was, you know, that was a good thing. You know, when you got a good film, it's a lot to do with, you know, the characters and the setting that you build with it, and so that, you know, kind of carried on into part two a lot. And by part three they were sort of losing it a bit. I know they were the same characters, but it was kind of a different cast, really, wasn't it? So
come on, you gotta love 4. She moves off where she's living to a different island, and the shark finds her.
I know, it's completely
explain ridiculous. That one to me. I've yet to figure out the plot. Who decided that idea? I can understand a different shark I would have given it them, but I'm like, oh no, like, so if a shark is chasing me, I'm moving to like inner city where there's no shark could get to me.
Yeah, just move inland. Yeah, probably like the grandson of the shark or something getting revenge. It was, pretty ridiculous, wasn't it?
I agree. Maybe you've answered my next question by your first question, but I'm going to answer it again. It's Friday night. Your mates are over. What do you show them?
What do I show them? God, now you've put me on the spot. I guess maybe we'd put Netflix on, and I like a lot of comedies, actually. I mean, I know it's kind of completely different to Shadows of a Stranger, but I'd kind of like a lot of real silly comedies and lowbrow stuff.
You're putting on Benny Hill reruns? Is that what I'm coming over for?
what have I been watching recently? I was watching a Will Ferrell film, I think, on
The House.
Netflix recently. And,
probably The House.
Adam Sandler, yeah, he kind of makes makes a lot of his earlier ones were funny, I think.
Well, he attempted humor at that point. Now he just makes them to amuse himself, I think.
Yeah, he's probably flogging it a bit now, isn't he? But,
well, Ridiculous 6, Sandy Wexler, really, these are not good.
Yeah. I saw a poster for Happy Gilmore 2. I don't know if that was a real thing happening, but...
Oh, really? Okay, now you got me intrigued. I know nothing about Happy Gilmore 2. I've never seen it.
Yeah, I just saw it this evening, so I will look out with great interest for that.
Yeah, Happy Gilmore 1 is a pretty solid movie, so...
Yeah, it was fun, yeah.
Okay, yeah. At the cinema, what do you buy?
At the cinema. I watch anything.
No, what do you buy? Concession stand.
Oh, sorry. I buy ice creams, usually, yeah.
Ice creams?
Yeah, the cinema that I go to, they sell... They have an intermission, which is really cool. Often you don't get intermissions these days.
No, we don't have them where I am at all.
No, yeah, I mean, like, places like the Odeon, they just, they don't do them. But we have a sort of old kind of traditional cinema called Kinema in the Woods, and a place called Woodall Spa. It's another, I think it's actually a village near to where I live. And, it's this very quaint cinema. And, they do popcorn and everything, but, you can get ice creams as well.
So like an ice cream cone, you mean, or like a bowl of ice cream, or...
I think they do little bowls, but they do sort of like kind of ice lollies sort of thing. Even coffees as well. They do coffee and hot chocolate. I think that's what I had last time. Actually, was a hot chocolate. Now I think about it.
So I have a question: is it like a double bill theater, or is it just a like? I don't know how they have intermission. They must be showing two movies.
No, they just pause the film essentially.
Really.
Yeah, and I mean they even have an old Wurlitzer organ in one of the screens. So in the intermission, it'll rise up from the stage like they did 100 years ago, and some guy will be playing. I think he's a local guy to this place, and he comes along every Saturday and he plays this Wurlitzer, and extra entertainment.
That is awesome. I've never heard of that.
Then I thoroughly recommend this place. Yeah.
That is pretty cool. Well, I want to thank you for your time. Oh, and everybody can find your film on Amazon, and they can buy it from you. Is there a DVD in existence or no?
There's no DVD. We perhaps ought to get onto that, in fact, because we did have a Canadian ask us, because it's not available on the Amazon.
No,
Canadian.
It's not on Prime for sure. He's correct.
Yeah, so maybe that's what we need to look into, is a DVD. But yeah, it's on Amazon in the US, the UK, Germany, and Japan.
And again, the film is, I'm going to get crowd myself, Shadows of a Stranger. And thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks very much for having me. It's been great talking to you.
Have a great night.
You too. Cheers.